Hello, everybody, and welcome again to another episode of the Presidential Archives Uncovered, the podcast that brings to you cool clips from the collections of the Presidential Libraries of the U.S. National Archives. For this episode, I'll be featuring a number of audio clips from the Johnson Presidential Library and Museum. After World War II, the people of Vietnam, a French colony, sought liberation from France. When the French withdrew in 1954, the region was split into North and South Vietnam. The United States supported the government of South Vietnam in their struggle against communist North Vietnam, as well as against the communist Viet Cong in the South. After taking office in November 1963, President Johnson concentrated on domestic issues, such as civil rights and the war on poverty, while continuing the course on Vietnam set by his predecessors. This policy of modest support for the government of South Vietnam was to change in the summer of 1964. On August 2nd, the United States Navy destroyer Maddox repelled a North Vietnamese attack in the Gulf of Tonkin without American casualties. The president issued a warning to the North Vietnamese on August 3rd to refrain from another assault on an American ship or be subject to swift retaliation. Tuesday, August 4, 1964, was a day of startling news in the White House. The president planned to work on his legislative program, particularly by using the tactic many called the Johnson treatment, to encourage passage of the poverty bill, which was signed on August 20th as the Economic Opportunity Act. But two crises interrupted work that day. At 11:06 a.m. on August 4th, while the president was meeting with Congressman George Mahone about the poverty bill, Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara called to report that the Maddox, along with another destroyer, the Turner Joy, was once again under torpedo attack.
Right here in Latin America, on underdeveloped schools, and on underdeveloped aviation, and then we can set a little on our own people, our own boy, that are there that is going to work. And then I'd give them something for nothing. It's make them work for every dime of it, and we take a tax eater that's now in daddy's relief role and make a taxpayer out of it. If I make him work, and we'll take a part of that check.
Hello?
Secretary McNamara, line O.
Yes, Ross. President, we just had word by telephone from Admiral Sharp that the destroyer is under torpedo attack. I think I might get Dean Rusk and Mac Bundy and have them come over here and we'll go over these retaliatory actions, and then we ought to...
I sure think you'll agree with that, yeah.
And I've got a category here. I'll call it to them.
Now, where are these torpedoes coming from?
Well, we don't know. Presumably from these unidentified craft that I mentioned to you a moment ago. We thought that the unidentified craft might include one PT boat, which has torpedo capability, and two SWAT top boats, which we don't credit with torpedo capability, although they may have it.
What are these planes are doing around while they're being attacked?
Well, presumably the planes are attacking the ships. We don't have any word from Sharp on that. The planes would be in the area at the present time, all eight of them.
Okay. Now you get them over there, and then you come over here as soon as you can.
I'll do that, yeah.
A series of meetings about the U.S. responses to the attack followed throughout the day. At 12:35 p.m., the president presided over a 30-minute National Security Council meeting in the Cabinet Room of the White House to discuss the appropriate United States response. At 1:36 p.m., the president joined an 80-minute lunch meeting with his major foreign policy advisors. The National Security Council resumed deliberations at 6:15 p.m. Then the president, Secretary of State Dean Rusk, Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, and National Security Advisor McGeorge Bundy met briefly before they began a 6:45 p.m. meeting with the leadership of Congress. The 6:45 p.m. meeting with congressional leaders about the Tonkin Gulf incident was interrupted when FBI Assistant Director Kartha Deek Deloach called the president at 8:01 p.m. Deloach reported that three bodies had been found in Mississippi, and that the FBI thought the bodies were those of civil rights workers last seen on the evening of June 21, 1964, James Cheney, Michael Schwerner, and Andrew Goodman.
Yes, sir.
I think we ought to follow if we can. Not
yes.
Just leave it limbo.
Yes, sir.
Hey, give me Dick Loach. Mr. Loach talking to Walter.
Oh, thank you.
Dean, are you following him down here?
Dave,
yeah. Boulder? No, Lyndon Johnson.
Mr. President?
Yeah.
Mr. Hoover wanted me to call you, sir, immediately and tell you that the FBI has found three bodies 6 miles southwest of Philadelphia, Mississippi, the 6 miles west of where the civil rights workers were last seen on the night of June 21st. Now, a search party of agents turned up the bodies just about 15 minutes ago while they were digging in the woods and underbrush several hundred yards off Route 21 in that area. We're going to get a coroner there right away, sir, and we're going to move these bodies into Jackson, Mississippi, where we hope they can be identified. We have not identified them as yet as the three missing men, but we have every reason to believe that they are the three missing men. They were at the site of a dam that had been constructed near Philadelphia, Mississippi. Want to let you know right away, sir.
When are you going to make an announcement?
Within 10 minutes, sir, if it's all right with you.
All right. How are you going to make it? Where? From there? From?
I plan to make it from Washington here, sir.
Uh-huh.
This indicates the FBI has found three bodies but not identified them.
Okay, if you can hold it about 15 minutes, I think we'll notify these families.
Well, Mr. President, the only thing suggestion I'd have there is that you wish to do that prior to the time that they're identified. We think they're the ones, but...
Well, I think we could tell them that we don't know, but we found them, and that kind of eases it a little bit.
Yes, sir. All right, sir. Shall I wait till I...
Yeah, I'll get right back to you.
Very good, sir.
After talking with Deloach, the president immediately called White House Associate Counsel Lee White to relay Deloach's report.
Happening.
Give me Lee White, and if he's not there, Walter Jenkins right away.
Yes.
Lee White.
Lee White? And do you want Walter Jenkins?
No, Lee White, Lee White.
They found the three bodies in Mississippi. Who it is?
Dave.
Lee.
Yes, Mr. President.
They found those three bodies 6 miles south of southwest of Philadelphia, Mississippi. 6 miles west from where they last seen. They don't know that these are the bodies. They moved them into Jackson to identify them. They're off Route 21. It's right near the site of a new dam that's been built. They have every reason to believe they are the bodies. So, call the families and tell them that there'll be an announcement in the next 10 or 15 minutes. We'll, as soon as we get proper identification, let them know further.
All right, I'll call all three of them right now. All right.
Tell them I ask you to.
I will, Mr. President.
After consulting with his advisors and the congressional leadership, President Johnson decided to order retaliatory airstrikes against selected targets in North Vietnam in an operation named Pierce Arrow. He recognized, however, his responsibility to protect the American military forces involved in the operation by delaying his public announcement of Pierce Arrow until the bombers were safely away from the targets. He also wanted to notify Republican presidential candidate Senator Barry Goldwater before making the announcement.
Secretary Rusk on 9-0.
Yes? I feel myself that it's quite important that your statement be delayed until we have the action program to announce, and that can't be announced until the fellows have had a chance to be on target and away. If you make the statement without the reference to the specific action, it would seem to create great confusion all over the world for quite a few hours and among our own people. I don't know what your own problem is about airtime and that sort of thing, but I would hope that you could make your statement when it's safe to do so from the operational point of view.
Well, have you talked to McNamara about this?
I haven't on this particular point. No, I just talked to Mac Bundy. I'll call him and call you back if you wish me.
Yeah, you all better. Everybody's got a different idea, Dean. They're just running all over the lot.
All right, I'll call him and
wait. Oh, Mac, to get with McNamara. What does Bundy say?
Mac George Bundy?
Yeah.
I think he tends to agree with me on this. But let me get a hold of Bob McNamara. I haven't had a report on how much of an operational problem is involved.
Well, the plane's just starting to get off now, and it'll be after midnight before you can have any statement. So he suggests that you make a statement that action is of military nature is now underway. And he doesn't say that you give the name of the town or the kind of airplane you're driving or the size of the bomb, but they just say appropriate military action is now underway.
I see. Well, I'll check with him and we'll get coordinated on this.
At 11:36 p.m., the president went on television and radio to announce the retaliatory airstrikes. In that same statement, the president announced that he was asking Congress to consider a resolution stating that the legislative branch join the executive branch in its determination to take all necessary measures in support of freedom and in defense of peace in Southeast Asia. As August 4th drew to a close, the president turned his attention to his schedule for the next day. At 11:59 p.m., he spoke with Ambassador and former Governor Averill Harriman of New York about the president's trip to Syracuse on August 5th.
Averill?
Yes, Mr. President?
I hate to call you this late, but I cut your note and it had me busy all day and I was going to get away early in the morning. I thought I'd better call you.
Well, I didn't really mean to bother you. I wanted to talk to you about what you thought about Bob Kennedy's future in New York.
Good.
And one or two things about Syracuse. I think you can help there. The Democrats have been fighting. We've got a good county chairman, and Ron Lagan.
Yeah.
So it's worthy. He's worthy of your support.
All right.
I think your going there is going to be a very good thing.
Good. I'm just going to run up for... some of them thought I ought to cancel, but I don't think I will.
Did you what?
Some of them thought I ought to cancel it tonight, but I don't think I will. I think it'd create too much tension.
Yes, I think if you... When are you going to make your statement?
On the Vietnam?
Yeah.
I've already made it.
Oh, you've already made it?
Already made it, yeah.
So, we were just at Indian Embassy and we just got in.
Yeah, well, I just made it about 10 minutes ago.
Oh, good.
And... I'll call you.
I'm doing the right thing in this case, sir.
Well, thank you. I'll call you and I get back and we'll get together. How's that?
Can I do that?
That's fine.
I'd like to know what you want to... I think I have a little influence on Bob Kennedy, and I'd like to do it in a way that you think would be what's good for you.
I'll be very happy to, and I'll call you tomorrow or next day just as soon as I get back.
People up there in Syracuse, they ought to control that city. The city went for the first time in a long time for you and President Kennedy, and we ought to carry it again, but you ought to tell these Democrats they ought to get together and quit fighting with each other.
I sure do. I'll do it.
Well,
thank you.
I'm sure they'll appreciate you going very much.
Thank you, Averill. Bye.
In his speech at Syracuse University during that trip, the president's attention was once more focused on the communist challenge in Southeast Asia. He spoke of the unprovoked and deliberate attack upon the United States military by the North Vietnamese. He assured the world, buttressed by his telephone conversation with Senator Goldwater and his meetings with congressional leaders the previous day, that the United States government and people were united in their commitment to repel aggression from the North Vietnamese. On August 7th, Congress passed the Tonkin Gulf Resolution, which authorized the president to take all necessary measures to repel any armed attack against the forces of the United States and to prevent further aggression. The House approved the resolution unanimously, and the Senate passed it with only 2 dissenting votes. The President signed the resolution on August 10th. If you'd like to learn more about the Gulf of Tonkin or any of these audio clips that you've heard today, please visit the Presidential Timeline, www.presidentialtimeline.org.